Okay. So be aware this is being recorded, but it's only recorded for us. Okay, so no one else has access to it. So just a note then. It's interesting in a way doing this kind of course in Glastonbury. If you want to go on Glastonbury High Street and have conversations with some of the people, you can very quickly feel like you're in an open-air lunatic asylum, to use a rather non-PC word. And the connection between the imagination and magic and madness is one of the real things that's really kind of very rooted in our society. And partly it's a function of cultural things that happen in the 18th century, where rationality becomes and is seen as the principal mode of the respectable and valuable mode of human experience. And it's complicated, all this, because rationality is really important. So it's not to demonize the rational mind. Because sometimes when we can see to some degree some of the things happening around ISIL or IS, you can see something of the pre-scientific, pre-rational approach rising up into the world, combined with a lot of postmodern ideas as well. But there's something important about looking at the limitations of rationality, but not demonizing rationality. Because we go back to the time when into pre-rational things, what happens is religious forces tend to be very, very dominant. One of the reasons that one can feel relatively in a fairly benign way look at the Anglican Church in this country is because it hasn't any power anymore. If we go back to the Elizabethan period, for example, which is an interesting time in British history anyway, when the world is opening up and new ideas are flooding in. It's also a time of enormous, where belief systems, religious belief systems have enormous power and wield political power. And people die as a result of that. But one of the problems I think goes in swings and roundabouts. One of the problems with rationality. So one of the great things about rationality and the rise of empiricism and questioning and thinking breaks off shackles of blind belief. But what it can do and what it has done to a certain extent is cause us to undervalue and distrust our own intimate, non-rational creativity. Now, in our society, creativity is treated as there's a very schizophrenic attitude towards it. If it produces commodities that sell well, it's highly valued. Otherwise, it's discouraged. And in particular, things that a creativity that comes out of not knowing and mystery is often regarded as frightening. I always remember, some of you will have heard me tell this story before probably, but it's maybe worth telling again. When I was a kid, I come from this huge Welsh family on my mother's side anyway. And the aunties used to gather in my house about, kind of once a month, something like that, to have their kind of get together. There's about 12 of them. And on the surface, it's a nice family get together. What it actually is competitive parenting. where the aunties tell it, where the aunties brag about how well their kids are doing and sort of bitch about everybody else's kids, so that, you know, so they get to feel, so they get to be top sister basically. And this is one occasion when I was listening in on this, and sort of and it's one of these things, times where, you know, you should never really eavesdrop, actually, because the cleavage is likely to be about you, because you know it's the old truism, you never hear good about yourself. So what I heard was my auntie Shirley discussing me. And so Shirley, to my mother's called Constance, we called her Con. So Shirley was going, "How's Ian doing, Con?" "Oh, my mum's in all right, still trying, I don't know, you know, warily, you know, because it's, you know, these questions are never without consequence in those meetings." So Shirley persists, "You're Ian Con, he's not very into rugby, is he?" In certain parts of Wales, that's like saying race traitor, right? That's a sort of effeminate race traitor, ballet dancer, gay, really, all these cluster of associations, yes? And my mother is, of course, forced to admit that is the case, because I loathe rugby. I didn't do it. I used to play full back, because I used to hang back and hope never to get the ball. And I just would literally be at the end of the field, looking from a distance, pretending I was waiting to stop somebody. So anyway, that bit happens. The next thing she does is sort of, "Course, he's a very sensitive boy." Now in Wales, that's not good, right? So to be a sensitive boy, that doesn't mean, isn't it nice he's a sensitive boy? It really means useless, will never do anything, never come to anything in the world. But then she went in for the kill with the phrase, "Of course, he's very imaginative, just like his uncle Simon, or great uncle Simon." Well, basically, my great uncle Simon I never knew him, but was taken off into the mental institution, and basically what she's saying, really, you know, he's not a proper bloke, he's not proper, he's not real, he's going to be mad. He's too imaginative, he's going to be mad. And in a way, that's kind of, that's, I'm parodying Shirley a little bit, but not much, actually. We've all got a bit of Shirley in us. The problem isn't Shirley. Actually, the problem is the parts of us which agree with Shirley, that are worried about our sensitivity, that are worried about the parts of ourselves that are intuitive. And the fear that somehow, if we really address that and really engage with that and really trust that, then maybe we'll go mad. And I've been working with these things for years and years and years, and there's still some part of me doubts it, doesn't believe it, struggles with it. So one of the things that we will, in a way, be looking at is this part, is the auntie Shirley's the archetype. Shirley's become an archetype in my head now, is it? It's the auntie Shirley's within us, that are the places that will tell us that we're mad or silly or wrong. We should be doing something more substantial, more important, more saleable. And yet, it is this mysterious place that the ideas that change the world come from. And if we can trust ourselves, what we will find is that energy, of that life energy, that breath will come into our world in whatever way is right for us. But what we will also find is that we have to keep trusting something mysterious. Now the question is how to do that. Now in a way, that's the question this course is designed to address. So the materials that I'm using are bridges into that we can, and some will speak to you and some won't, but the key thing is to choose the things that work for you, that enable you to connect to that mysterious place inside yourself where new life emerges. Now, to a certain extent, therefore, what we have to do is draw on, where can we find these forms? Where have people looked into these things? And it is in these now disreputable areas of occultism, the, word occult means hidden, so it's the hidden life. It is in things like poetry that we've lost the knack of understanding and valuing. So we have to look at some of these societies and times and peoples and practices where people did know something about these imaginative abilities, did know how to trust them and did know how to work with them. And from that, eventually, what happens as we work with these forms, the forms in the end become redundant. The Buddha had this kind of great saying, really, where he regarded his teachings as being like a raft, and that to get you across a river. Now, once you've crossed the river, you don't stick the raft on your head and carry it around. You let the raft be until you need it again. Maybe you go back across the river, you're going to need your raft again. So you lay your raft down. And in a way, there's two principal kind of forms or streams that we're going to be looking at. We're going to be looking at the form called the Kabbalah and this image called the Tree of Life, which comes from the myth of Genesis. And this idea of, because the myth of Genesis, which is one of the central myths of Western Europe, Christian Europe, Judaic Europe, originating out of the Middle East, where it's found not just in Judaism, but you find it in Sumeria, you find it in Babylonium. So it's a very central ancient kind of myth that's about the sense of the garden of perfection that is lost and how to find that again. Now, in the Adam and Eve myth, which is the one that we're most familiar with, there's this sense, it's a very interesting myth, really, because in the, I feel like the myth as it is taught to us, mainly, and as it was taught in the Christian and Jewish religions, is it's a myth of disobedience, that human beings don't obey the good God who is looking after them. And therefore, they are thrown out of paradise, and have to learn and suffer to learn to obey the good God again. So it's a myth of conformity. It's a myth that says, it's also a myth about human evil that says there is something wrong with us which we must learn to put right. The Kabbalists, however, had a different take on that myth, They have a phrase, the Hebrew phrase, which says that the serpent is the Messiah, Nashash Messiah, which means that the serpent who tempts Eve to eat the apple is inviting these archetypal figures into a deeper engagement with life. Into away from a static perfection, a childlike place, right? So, because you have this image, so the Garden of Eden image in the beginning is of the naked man and woman living in perfect harmony in this beautiful kind of place. It's a kind of childhood myth. It's a myth of a perfect, being looked after by a perfect parent. And in the evening, God walks with them in the garden and sort of makes sure they're happy and all right, you know. So, it's a bit like daddy comes home. And looks after the children and takes them by the hand, and it's beautiful. It's not without its beauty, but it's static. Now the serpent is this agent of chaos and mystery. Now in the older traditions, the serpent actually is the vehicle of wisdom. But of a wisdom that's serpentine, it's not straightforward. It curls around things. It swivels. It can bite. It can kill. It's dangerous. There's an edge of danger and excitement in the serpent. And it messes up perfection. It's the sort of the loose cannon. What it causes is this dynamic process to occur. Where instead of living in an imagined static perfection, Adam and Eve are then in a world that challenges, that opposes, that they have struggle with. And that in that struggle creates new abilities, new capacities. And the other, there's another tree in the garden. That's a tree that is not spoken. So there's a tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So where Adam and Eve go, where the serpent takes them, is to live within the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, of opposites, of separation and anxiety, of safety and connection. Learning about that, working with that. And at a certain point, and when they're the other thing that can happen there is that they can start to eat of the tree that is in the middle of the garden, the tree that brings opposites together. So the other bit of the Kabbalistic myth here is that we are living in a world of opposites, of challenges, that develops capacities in us that enables us to eat of the tree of life. The tree that is in the middle of the garden, that is in the middle of your own experience, that brings everything together. It's a sort of, in Jungian terms, it's a mandala image. It's a tree with four rivers. That garden of paradise includes everything. The mandala is the whole sphere of your own life. So you, in a certain sense, when you follow this particular path, you become the living tree in the middle of the living garden that is your own life. That is not the static garden of childhood. That is not perfect. That actually is this dynamic, moving thing. That where perfection is found in movement and activity and the relationship between stillness and movement. Where you yourself are the center, that connects everything. So it's a totally different kind of image from that kind of image of the normal image of the Garden of Eden, which is where you have to get over your sins, you have to repent, you have to make yourself right with God. Actually, what this myth would say is you have to get interested in the places that disturb you. The serpent is the savior. Nashash Mashiach. In Hebrew, it means it's more interesting as well, because the Hebrew letters are also numbers. And one of the things that the Hebrew Kabbalists would do, they felt that two words had the same name, a same number, there was a relationship between them, and Nashash and Mashiach have exactly the same number. And so it's a sort of little koan, or kind of little poetic device that they're using, but they're using it to point at a profound inner truth, in a way, that these places that disturb you, if held in a particular way, if held with awareness, if held with inquiry and interest, that bring salvation. It is the opening and development of new capacities. Now they go on to develop an image of now this tree of life image, of course, is this very ancient image you find in all traditions. You find it in Welsh tradition, comes out of the Middle East. They go on to form a particular geometric form of that, that actually helps us to really engage with our inner processes and to bring things into a place of balance and active balance. So I'll talk about that a little bit later this weekend. But that's one of the great myths that we're going to look at, and we'll be running this through the whole 2 years. It's an important myth to look at, and if you have, if you're brought up in any religious way yourself, you'll have reactions to it, and that's good. So we can bring these reactions into the room. The other reason for looking at it, of course, it's a central myth of the development of the West. This idea of it underlies all the Abrahamic religions in some way, because the superficial understanding or the exoteric understanding of it is there is one God, one way. Human beings are sinful and need to be brought back to the one way, need to be brought to obedience. So obedience can mean, it can mean, if you're a Jew, it can mean, it can mean keeping the covenant, keeping the halakhic rules. If you're a Christian, it means believing in Christ. If you're a Muslim, it means obeying Allah and keeping the Sharia. So this myth, taken in one way, is this oppressive monomyth that drives out all other forms of belief. Taken as an inner process, however, it celebrates the connection. It celebrates two things: the underlying unity of everything in the mysterious place, and the delight in the thousand gardens that appear in people's hearts, as a result of trusting that mysterious kind of process and trusting the energy of the serpent, who then becomes the savior. So that's one enormous myth pattern that we will work with. The other thing that we will look at is this image of the matter, as Benjamin referenced, the matter of Britain, which is the Arthurian stories that come out of the out of Welsh tradition originally. Though even there, you find my friend John Matthews believes them to be an ancient Sarmatian story from Central Asia. And who really knows? I mean, the thing is, when you go back far enough, you know, actually, the thing about all myths and all stories, once you go back far enough, you have no idea where things come from. And things travel across the world. You know, there's a 12th century story called The Life Vita Merlini, The Life of Merlin, which I'll talk to you about at some point. And that has within it Middle Eastern teaching stories that come out of Central Asia. And almost certainly Geoffrey of Monmouth, who wrote this, had no idea where these stories came from. But things travel from word of mouth way across the world. The world, ancient world, much more connected than ever with it than we might imagine. So the thing I like about myths and stories is that they're actually, again, they come out of a mysterious place. And one of the problems with all myths is that people claim them. You know, and certainly one of the things that you can find sometimes around the Welsh stories is, and I continually take exception to this, is people feeling that you have to understand Welsh to understand the Arthurian stories or the Welsh poems. Or it's useful to say, I love Welsh, it's a lovely language, a bloody difficult language, as Fern is demonstrating for us all. Like, you know, it does my head in, and I was taught it as a child. Still does my head in, it's very difficult. But actually, it really isn't essential at all. It's not cultural imperialism in some ways to claim that actually, to really understand and make use of these stories, you have to be Welsh. It's actually a dangerous image. It's not terribly dangerous. The Welsh aren't likely, we're a very little country, we're not likely to rise up and try and kill everybody else who isn't Welsh. Although, you know, if you look at what happened in the Balkans, the Serbs were bigger than the Welsh for sure as a nation, but took a hold of their mythology, became empowered by it, and acted on that in such a way as to murder many, many, many thousands of people. I remember, just by way of illustrating that, years ago, I was watching telly, it's just after the fall of the Soviet Union, and where all the new states were starting to arise, and BBC had a program about Radovan Karadzic. Incredibly positive progress well before the Bosnian conflict, and people were selling, you know, the West was very triumphant because the evil empire had fallen, and, you know, sort of democratic capitalism was saving the world. Did a very good job, did it not? And Radovan Karadzic was an example of the new Europe, and this was an incredibly flattering program about this man who was a psychiatrist, who was a poet, philosopher. Isn't it brilliant that, you know, men like this are arising? And it was all, you know, it was quite interesting. I was, you know, BBC do these sort of things really well, so I was quite fascinated by it. What I remember is there was one moment that really kind of chilled me, and I didn't understand until, of course, a lot later. Him and his mates were up a mountain. They were singing old Serbian folk songs about how the white eagle of Serbia would rise again and to drive out the Turk. And of course, it's not the only reason why that happened, but actually that myth lived again in people, that wish to kind of destroy the Turk. And they did. So, you know, that's literally ethnic cleansing, the rounding up of the Muslims. It's not the only reason why that happened. There's lots of politico kind of economic reasons as well. But it is one of the things that one of the dangers of myth, if it's not made conscious, if it's not engaged with, if it's not brought into the tree of life, you could say, brought into a living place, it becomes this dead form that drives people from behind. UKIP are doing it now. UKIP are raising in the consciousness of the nation, I think, a sense of the necessary isolation of Britain against the foreigner. Because most of these racial myths are about, you know, they go back to very primitive levels inside ourselves about, about fear of the dangerous stranger. And the myth acts as a place of binding us together. It binds those who know the myth, who are included, who are part of the holy people, who are the guardians and custodians of the myth. And it binds them together normally against another. You know, the cohesion depends also about having the evil snake somewhere that you have to kill. You have to, you know, in the Christian myth, the head of the serpent is crushed under the heel of the Mother of Christ. Although the serpent anciently is one of the great images of the goddess, you know, so there's a, so how, so myth is a double-edged thing. So we've been looking at these myths inside ourselves and working with them. The other thing that I hope you'll be able to do is to look at how myth plays out in the culture and in the life of nations. And one of the things that's interesting about the Grail myth, to come back to that, is that this is the version that the Prithaihandavendu should be looking at is one of the very early, one of the reasons for using this poem, this is one of the very earliest accounts of the search for the Grail. In this place, it's this Arthur and his lads go off to find the cauldron of inspiration from the other world. It's very, very, one of the things that's very nice about these old Welsh poems is that meaning in them is very concentrated, and as we look at it, actually, you'll discover more and more about that myth. And then we will look at how it travels through time. And, you know, for example, the Arthurian things in the sort of Victorian era, incredibly popular. Tennyson writes the Idylls of the King. And it's the thing about it's incredibly useful to the British Empire. The Tennyson's sort of version of history is, because it has this image of the perfect knights going out into the world to civilize the heathen, which is a brilliant rationale for when you're setting up an empire. It's brilliant. You're having to sort of subdue these people, because the Arthurian stories are full of Arthur and his knights killing the enemy kings and bringing them into the chivalrous traditions of Camelot. And so one of the political shadow edges of that is again part of the monomyth, where the British Empire dominates the world and brings civilization to the heathen. So one of the things that you find, so the Arthurian stories are incredibly popular in that time. And, you know, Elliot and I used to know a guy called Jonathan when we lived in Gloucestershire. He was a farmer. Jonathan, but he was completely out of that world. Jonathan longed for the British Empire to be reborn, because he wanted to go out. He wanted to be the knight going out he'd have loved to be the sort of provincial governor or something, or kind of colonial administrator. And you could see how that those images not the only thing going on in people, but they are underneath the surface, pushing people from behind. So part of the understanding that comes out of working with myth is how it is to see how is myth active in our time. If we go back to Iraq for a moment and look at Blair and Bush, and look at the correspondence between some of the things they're saying and the image of crusades and crusaders, which was certainly the Islamic world were shrieking about crusaders and sort of, because they were right. There was this kind of, you know, there's a version of it here again, you know, the sort of, you know, the West needs to go in and sort out the dangerous Saracens. The Saracens, if you like, in this case, they want to re-establish the caliphate. This is a medieval Islamic image. So they're doing barbaric medieval things like beheading people in public. So these myths are in a way dangerous things if they're not held consciously, if they're not held in awareness. If they're held in awareness, they become something else. They become these bridging living forms that connect us. Now the image of the whole Arthurian story is actually a wonderful story if we hold it as a description of something to work with. The thing I like about the Arthurian story is it's a bit of a mess. There's no perfect Camelot at the end of it. It ends, everything falls apart. And it ends with the promise of the king will come again. It doesn't end with static perfection. The various characters in it are all, they're all like ourselves, they're like we are, they've got double edges. We have high aspirations and beliefs and wishes. We have shadowy sides and shadowy motivations. So to work with figures like Merlin, like Arthur, like Guinevere, like Morgan Le Fay, to really engage with these figures inside ourselves is to be able to look at the double-sidedness of our own nature. It is, in a way, you could say, to look at the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And by being with the opposites inside ourselves, to find the living tree that can bind these opposites together and bring them into new life. And the grail is this mysterious thing that is sometimes described as a cup, sometimes as a dish, sometimes as a cauldron, sometimes as a stone. I mean, the common idea of the grail is the cup, is Jesus' cup. But actually, if you really read the grail, nobody quite knows what the grail is. It is this mysterious thing. And you don't know when it is going to appear. You can't pin it down. So at the heart of this myth, there is this thing that everybody's searching for that has the capacity to heal all wounds and to feed everybody with the exact food that they most like to eat in all the world. It also powerfully affects people's senses. It's very embodied. It carries an enormous, beautiful smell with it. And immediately you are given the food you like most to eat. And it's the other thing about the grail is it's ephemeral. It keeps vanishing. You keep having to search for it. It's a process that leads you to moments of knowing, and then that moment is gone again. Again, it's not static. The cauldron of inspiration that we will study in the poem is a moving cauldron. Warmed, as is in the poem, is warmed by the breath of nine maidens. So it's speaking about the great feminine archetype, the great image of the goddess, the feminine side of human beings. But immediately the poem then suddenly brings us, talks about the sword of light, the sword of Chaminach. Who carries the sword of light? Chaminach means the leaper, the one who jumps over obstacles. So we've immediately, well, I'll talk more about this when we look at the poem itself, but you've got, the poem juxtaposes opposites together. So we've got this very space of gentle breath warming a cauldron, something bubbling in the depths of the cauldron. Next minute we've got this sword of light and this this male figure leaping over things, finding the way. And one of the things that's said about the cauldron, which is in the possession of Pen Anuven. Now, Pen Anuven in Welsh means it's almost at the head of Anuven, the chieftain of Anuven. But it can also mean, Pen can also mean origin, source. So the cauldron, it can be said to be the cauldron that comes from the source of Anuven, the source of the very deep place that is not a place. Later on the poem, there's all these questions about, you know, there's wonderful things in the poem about the Lord's bookmen. Probably about the bookkeeper. So don't take it personally. But it's speaking about it's actually talking about the bookmen inside ourselves, not actually the bookkeeper at all, but the bookmen, which is the literal parts of ourselves, that do not understand who created who, that do not know the moment when the chick is born, who do not know who the Lord of Anuven is. Now, really, the Lord of Anuven is ourselves. It is that we are Pen Anuven. We will just explore all this. But the part of ourselves that is like the Lord's bookman, or is like this brilliant other image of the monks crowding together, like a choir of wolves or howling dogs. Those parts of ourselves, the part that do that, the parts of ourselves that want to be identified as normal and as knowing and as not different, are the parts that crowd together like the howling dogs, like the choir wolves, and they are defeated, it says, by a contest, in a contest with those who know. Now this is the knowing, a knowing that is not the same as the knowing of the Lord's bookmen or the monks who know the liturgy. It is the knowing of mystery. It's this interesting phrase of the sea being one water, or fire being one fierce spark of tumult, of energy. So the knowing that you find in those who know is that knowing of the mysterious, the knowing of the origin of things, the knowing that also things are deeply connected in a mysterious way. That all water is one water, all air is one air, all earth one earth, all fire one fire. You know, it's all the systems of the bike being one, not being one, that's the one thing wrong. It's that. But that shift is a big shift, right? Because actually all our culture says to us all the time, you have to know. What are you doing? What's your strategy? What's, you know, I'm a psychotherapist, and a number of times new clients say, okay, what's the plan? But our news guy says, there is no plan. This is a version of, I don't quite say it like that, of course, but that's kind of what I do say. And the thing that helps them and me in that moment is, of course, I have confidence in the not knowing, in the not planning. I'm not saying the plan, I'm demonizing planning, but if plans come out of mystery, well, that's one thing. But when plans come out of that literal part of the mind, there's a problem, because that problem with the Lord's bookman part of ourselves is it can only work on what it already knows. So it is the prisoner of its own history. One of the other great images that we have in the poem Prithayanun is this image of a prisoner whose song is heard throughout the world, and whose song is resonant or is connected to these strange figures called Pwyll a Pryderi. Now, Pwyll a Pryderi come out of a book of stories called the Mabinogion, which roughly translated is the youthful stories of Mabon, who is a sort of a Welsh demigod figure. and the whole story of Purk and Pradevi is all about imprisonment and freedom. So partly the poem is also talking about helping us look at how we imprison ourselves and how we free ourselves. Now what we'll be doing, in a way, is weaving together these two myth patterns, this myth pattern of the Tree of Life and this myth pattern of from the Welsh traditions. I mean, I'll be doing that. You will take from it whatever is valuable for you. It's you know, your job is really just to be here, we'll participate together, we'll talk together. And all you are required to do is just take away what feels useful. My job is to try and help you bridge and make connections between the everyday part of yourself and the part of yourself that really is very comfortable with the mystery, very comfortable with these deeper places. In the course of that process, we will have to look at these places where you do feel lost or trapped or imprisoned, and how to kind of help you connect into something deeper. And in particular, how to value your own unique, essential creativity, which is yours alone and which the world needs. It's not easy to do that, because what will have happened to you all, and certainly happened to me, is your creativity gets restricted in some way, or even banished sometimes, by things that you are told. As a child, not just told, but actually things that happen to you. So you learn, or you think, that the real creativity is somewhere else. In special people, special places. Or you have to undergo terrible processes in order to find that. The place for me where the Arendt program came from was I was sitting it's a place called Hawkwood, where my friends run these workshops, and sometimes I teach with them, but this time I was enjoying, like some of you have said, just being a participant and just not having any, I wasn't even expecting anything much from it in some ways. But what happened to me was we were working on this poem and visualizing going into a castle and down into the depths and sort of finding a prisoner. And the prisoner I found, where I went to, it was interesting, because I found myself in a part of Drykefn Park. I love having Fernia. She's very other than Ali. She's the one person I've ever met in my life who knows Drykefn Park, where I was brought up. It's a real kind of, so I could say Drykefn Park, and you're going to know what I mean. It's nice. I love that. it took me into the place that I was brought up, which is a sort of into my family, in a way, right into the wounding of my own family somewhere, and it took me into a really particular ambivalence I have around my Welsh upbringing and the things that are meaningful to me from that tradition. So the place where and recognizing that actually I needed to do serious work with these Welsh traditions, because they are very important to me, and yet I am also very repelled by them. Part of me hates them because of the, you know, I grew up in this very depressed family, depressed village, incredibly small world, small, misogynistic, racially intolerant world. You know, a world with a lot of depth, really, but incredible narrowness.
It still is.
Yeah, no, I know. Of course I do. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the trouble, isn't it? So you, the thing is that that's exactly right. And so there, you find this thing that is beautiful and powerful, and it has this horrible kind of feeling about it. Now, this is my own version of the, right, so the Awen program in some ways, or the thing around all this, is my own attempt to look at these splits, these problems inside myself. But we will all have a version of that. So in our relationship to our, there will be an ambivalence, an inevitable ambivalence to our own life energy, our own creativity, to the things, our belief in ourselves. So as we touch that, we will find delight and likely fear and repulsion. So it's how to be with that, and how to help other people be with that is some of the challenges really that we will face. One of the things that the great lines in the poem is that, you know, what is the nature of the cauldron of Anavin, the cauldron of inspiration? Well, one of its natures is it will not boil the food of a coward. Because it takes a degree of courage to do this, to stay there. And to stay there long enough for the food to be cooked takes a lot of courage. Because we can touch there, we can touch that deep place, touch the place where the cauldron in us is found. But then we have to have the courage to stay there until the food is cooked. And that means touching and experiencing the prisoner, our version of the prisoner. And in that process, discovering something about the process of imprisonment and freeing ourselves from imprisonment. The poem is said to have been written by Taliesin Penbeirth, Taliesin chief bard, Taliesin. This word pen, which means chieftain, but also means origin, means the archetypal bard. There's a picture of Taliesin up on the wall there that my friend Stuart Littlejohn painted. And Taliesin is this, at one level he's believed to be a 5th century Welsh bard, but he's also this great archetypal figure. Who is connected with the root of inspiration and connected in particular with the process of transformation, and also he is also connected with the experience of imprisonment and freedom. We'll look at the story of Taliesin in part of the work, but there are a collection of stories in the Welsh canon called the Poems of Taliesin. And where they come from, nobody really knows. But they're attributed to this ancient kind of figure. But they all have this very concentrated, very powerful effect when you look at them and study them. And the studying is not intellectual study. It's being with mysterious things you don't understand that then stimulate something inside you. So the thing about if you go away not knowing anything, that'll be a serious result. Because actually the point is, I'm not here to teach you the meaning of the Welsh poems. I'll give you pointers about how to work with them. I'll certainly give you some of my understandings, you've got something to compare with. But these things they act like sort of seeds. They germinate inside you and they come up as something else. You know, the plant and the seed look totally different from each other. If you didn't know that a seed was related to a plant, you'd have nothing to suggest that it is, you know, an acorn. Acorn doesn't look like an oak tree. If you didn't actually see them growing on the tree, there would be no known relationship between them. Similarly, the particular tree that you grow, the particular garden that arises from you, may have no obvious relation at all to these things that we're studying. Yet they will be connected because they will have acted as seeds or germination points or bridges that will have activated a process inside you. About 10 minutes before lunch. Let's just see if there's any thoughts or questions before we break. So we'll break from 12:30 to 2 to give you time for a proper lunch and just a bit of space. And then at 2 to 3, we'll start to look into some of these things experientially. And in the afternoon, I'm also going to give you the Kabbalistic model for looking at these things. And tomorrow I'll look more at the poem, probably. But let's just see where you are at the moment and what's moving in you. Oh, before I do that, so I always do that. I invite questions. I think something else. But I'll just tell you. I just want to say something about this. This image actually comes from a book called The She by my friend John Matthews. I've no idea where he got it from. I suspect he made it up. He pretends that he found it in an ancient barrow in Ireland, and he knows I know that it's not true. But he wrote this slightly semi-fictional thing. It's a nice little book actually about working with never imaginative things. But the reason I like it, he's kind of let me use it. So. Is wherever he got it from, it's a great image, because it's an when you look at it, it phases in and out from the black and the white. It's also got this, it also contains these two images of the sword and the cauldron, because it's got this sense of continual boiling rotations and then this energy that flashes through. And that's what I think the energy of creativity is like. Actually, you know, the so-called instant insight actually comes normally because all kinds of movement has happened. And so this image it's a great staring pattern, this image, because it just takes you into a slightly different place, and of course it's right at the heart of the process that we're looking at. So that's why that's there. Anyway, let's just see if there's anything else any of you want to say before we break for lunch.
I was just going to say, if it didn't have the line going down through the middle of it would be a labyrinth.
Yeah.
So therefore you're going in one way and coming out.
Yep.
Another, so you've got that movement.
Yeah.
Because there's a line down through, obviously, you don't have that way in, so you've got the two sides.
That's right.
So I thought that straight away, but without, it's the line through the middle that actually.
It alters it. Off. Yes, it alters it. That's right, yeah. That's right.
You can't get in, you have to find another way in.
That's right, yeah, exactly. Yes, it isn't. Yes, that's right. It's a different dynamic for the labyrinth.
Because you go in through.
Yeah.
Sorry, it was pennies. Through this bit, if the line was.
Yeah, that's
there,
right.
Follow it round and work your way back out.
Yeah.
It's blocked before you start.
That's right.
You have to find another way into the centre, to the core.
That's right, exactly. That's right. And that's really part of it, because that's part of this whole thing is looking at blocks and looking at movement. You know, so that's exactly right. Yeah, definitely. It's really nice. Yeah.
Very interesting what you said about myth, because it strikes me that these sort of liminal spaces, you know, the mythic realm and the human realm and all this sort of thing, it's very easy to get mixed up and try and interpret mythic things literally.
Yeah.
And, you know, and this is, you know, where you get the sort of power force behind the Nazis, for example.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's so strong that they're now having to be reintroduced to their own myths because it's been such a taboo subject. And because I see it in modern Druidry a lot.
Mm.
You know, people want to work with myth and they're not quite sure how, so they externalise it and take on a mythic persona that seems to say they can mediate that for other people.
Mm.
And I just see people who try and do this getting quite swollen up and poisonous with this sort of energy.
Yeah.
They don't, and it seems, you know, these literal interpretations are very, very dangerous.
No, I think you're absolutely right about that, and I think that's very commonly what people do, and particularly around here. People, you know, you come across people who decide they're mediating Merlin or think they're Merlin, or if you think of that guy, I was just thinking about that. That guy called the of King Arthur, who does all the political activism, and he almost literally is swollen by that. You know, he's completely out of it in some ways because he's so identified with the figure of Arthur. That it subsumed his ordinary human personality. Yeah. And that's a genuine danger about this. It's one of the things Jung used to warn about possession by an archetype. You know, you work with an archetype, but you humanize it. There's a lovely image, the thing you find in Jung's Red Book, where He finds the god Izdubar. And Izdubar is the old name for the culture hero Gilgamesh, who's one of the ancient Sumerian gods. And Izdubar is ill because of the rise of science and sick. And Izdubar tries to persuade Jung to worship him and restore his cult so that Izdubar will become well again. And Jung says, "No, I'm not going to do that, but I will make you well." And what he does is he does this rather neat thing of he shrinks Izdubar and he puts him into an egg and he puts him in his pocket and he carries him about and he sings to him until Izdubar hatches out within him in a new form. And it's rather lovely, isn't it? I mean, because of course, if you demand, I mean, what, you know, Jung could have done, well, I will renew the cult of Gilgamesh of Izdubar, and people do this when they enact these things. And of course, you'd then be just repeating something very ancient and wouldn't have much relevance to a modern age. But what Jung does, and what Jung literally does around these ancient things, is he takes them into himself. He makes them human-sized. And then he incubates them within himself so that the form, so the energy, that ancient energy isn't lost. It comes up in a new form within the, you know, it hatches from the egg. This is one of the images you get in Prithayun, the hatching from the egg. So we'll look at this image. It's quite important as a way to work with these myths. So that it comes up in a new form, a new energy, a new creativity.
There's lots in folklore about, you know, giants and various people having a bit of themselves in a secret place in an egg or whatever, isn't
that? Yeah, that's right. Mm. Yes, that's right. And these are sort of, and in a way, these are great images for, you could say, lost parts of ourselves. That because it, you know, the hero often goes to find that place and sort of, and then he finds that often the heart is given away. You know, the heart is kept somewhere else. And of course, literally, if people are very traumatized, sometimes you find that actually, you know, these core parts of themselves are displaced from them, so they're not felt. You know, the sense of people often don't feel like they've got a core or something at their center, and you find that literally sometimes their heart is placed somewhere else to protect it. And part of the work then is to try and help them recover that and find it again and bring it back into themselves.
Interesting dynamic because people, you know, make a big deal about the therapeutic process, and I'm in a room like this, I know absolutely nothing about it, but what I mean, there is the essential truth that, you know, woundedness is very our woundedness is very valuable,
yes,
to us, yet our trauma is the thing that actually cuts us off from everything, isn't it?
So that's right.
There's two sort of opposing things.
That's right.
You're traumatized, you're completely catatonic, if you like.
That's right.
You can't feel anything.
Yeah. And that is necessary to protect you at that time. That cutting off is a way of, you know, that imprisonment, if you like to use the image of the poem, that imprisoning of a part of yourself contains that part and keeps you safe in that moment. The problem is then that you've then cut off from a certain part of your life energy. And so the you're right, it's kind of double-edged, this, really. So and so we're back with the snake is the saviour. So that wounded, disturbing, painful thing, in the process of healing that, develops capacities that wouldn't have been there otherwise. You know, and you know, you can't say it's good to traumatise people, but there is this capacity within us that works with whatever we've got to develop capacities that wouldn't be otherwise there. And that's the goodness that comes out of trauma or woundedness or painful past events. So there is something, I guess that's one of the key things, as we said here at the beginning of all this, of to whatever extent we can, trying to value everything that has happened to us that brings us to this point, even the disturbing, difficult things. That's where the snake is the saviour. Even the most horrible, awful things that have happened to us, somewhere there is some energy of possibility that can arise from that if we work with it in a particular way. It's not to say that the events that happen to us are good. That's a different thing. That's a different thing. It's to say that nothing is wasted. Everything can be the vehicle for deeper development, to take us into the place where we are ourselves pen anuven, at the head, at the centre of the deep place. Okie dokie, we're now at half 12.